As with many events, the most unsettling aspect of the Ebola virus is the unknown. We're fortunate that researchers do know a lot about Ebola and procedures to contain an outbreak. Still, there remains a lot they don't know. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce has been talking with scientists who want to find out more.
The unprecedented Ebola outbreak has more virologists thinking about Ebola than ever before. Vincent Racaniello studies viruses at Columbia University.
I find myself reading incessantly about Ebola when I should be doing other things.
He gets a lot of questions, too. People ask him how Ebola might mutate as it moves through large numbers of people, as it's doing now in West Africa. Could it become more or less deadly? Racaniello says there are examples of other viruses that changed over time to cause milder illness.
But for the most part, most of the major viruses we know, AIDS, HIV-1, influenza, polio, measles, they all keep their virulence at pretty much the same level, although you could argue we've only been studying them a short time.
He and his virologist buddies wish they knew some really basic things about Ebola, like how does the virus actually slip into cells? What part of the cell's surface does it latch onto to get access? Knowing that might let scientists figure out ways to block it. And how do outbreaks of Ebola actually start?
This is a really important question, because if we could figure out where the virus comes from, we might be able to take measures to stop that.
Scientists believe the virus usually circulates in fruit bats. They seem to carry Ebola without getting sick, but no one knows the details of how bats pass it on to humans or other animals. Jonathan Epstein is an epidemiologist with EcoHealth Alliance, an organization devoted to understanding and predicting the emergence of diseases.
We're still trying to understand fully how other animals might get Ebola virus from bats. In other words, we know for sure that gorillas and chimpanzees and some antelope have been infected with Ebola in the past, but the mechanism for spillover isn't totally clear, and so that's an area where more study needs to be done.
Does it spill over into people directly from bats or from other infected animals or both? And once the virus finds its way into people, why is it that some people get very sick, others seem to get less sick, and others may not get sick at all? Angela Rasmussen is at the University of Washington in Seattle. She says we don't yet know of any genes that might influence someone's response to this virus.
And in fact, prior to this outbreak in West Africa, there really haven't been that many human patients with Ebola, so these studies haven't really been conducted in people.
She and some colleagues have started to study this in mice. They report on the work this week in the journal Science. In a secure lab, they infected dozens of genetically diverse mice with the same Ebola virus. They saw a wide range of disease outcomes, all the way from mild to severe illness, showing that the genetic makeup of individual mice played a huge role in how sick they got. Rasmussen says there were key differences in genes that affect blood vessels.
So we think that those genes may be implicated in Ebola pathogenesis, but we're still in the process of conducting studies on enough mice to be able to say that definitively.
Besides genes, scientists wonder what else might affect who lives and who dies. Robert Gary is a microbiologist at Tulane University. He and some colleagues have just published an analysis in the New England Journal of Medicine that looks at people who got ill in Sierra Leone. They found that a person's age really mattered. 57% of people under the age of 21 died. That's not good, but Gary says for older people, it was even worse.
If you were over 45, the case fatality rate was 94%, so a very small chance of surviving.
They're not sure why. It may be something to do with the differences in their immune systems. And even though Ebola is a hemorrhagic fever, it's associated with bleeding, Gary says bleeding was rare in their study. They only saw it in one patient. He says it looks like this West African variant of the virus is different than the ones that have been seen in Central Africa in the past.
It's something that we need to examine further to try to see what these differences are in terms of the viral biology.
That's just one example of how this outbreak, the largest ever, is an opportunity to get answers that might help scientists be better prepared to fight Ebola in the future. Nell Greenfield-Boyce, NPR News.
If you'll be dressing up a tiny ghost or goblin to trick-or-treat tonight, you will be faced with a problem later. A glut of candy, typically dumped on the living room floor or tucked away in a pillowcase. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports on one possible solution to that problem, Compliments of America's Dentists.
Halloween is supposed to be scary and mysterious, the night of the wandering dead. But for most kids, this is what it's really about.
Say trick or treat!
It's about the candy. Lots of us remember digging through our little plastic jack-o'-lanterns and gorging on Halloween night. I would trade anything to get my hands on more Almond Joys. But the problem, as Chris Kammer, a dentist in Wisconsin, sees it, is that for lots of kids, the candy gorging can go on for weeks.
If you think about it, a young child sitting with a shopping bag full of candy, they eat some of their favorites, then they start eating the things they don't even like just because it's there. The thought of that just makes me shudder.
So several years back, he had an idea. What if his dental practice offered to buy back Halloween candy from his young patients? Think of it as cash for candy. Kammer says he ran the concept by his own children.
When I first started telling my kids that, yeah, here's what we're going to do. We're going to buy kids candy back for $1 a pound. And they looked at me and they said, Dad, that's a terrible idea.
But Kammer decided to go ahead with it anyway. And to his surprise, he was not seen as the Halloween Grinch. It was a hit. Kids got some candy on Halloween night, and families were happy to drop off their excess at his dental office.
The first year we had done it, there was so much excitement about it. I mean, they were talking about it all over the state of Wisconsin. And then it was at that time I decided, wow, this could be the national response to Halloween.
There are now nearly 3,000 dentists signed up for the Halloween Candy Buyback Program. And what do they do with all of this candy?
The dentists send the candy to us at Operation Gratitude here in Southern California, and then we include it in our care packages that we send to U.S. military who are deployed overseas.
That's Carolyn Blaschek, the founder of Operation Gratitude, which has sent over 1 million care packages filled with things like DVDs, games, and personal grooming products to U.S. troops. She says adding the Halloween candy is a nice compliment.
Well, it's a great morale boost for the troops. It reminds them of home. It reminds them of the great traditions that we celebrate here. But most importantly to me, this provides an opportunity for every American child to say thank you to the military.
Last year, Blaschek collected about 250,000 pounds of candy to share. But with so many new dentists signed up,
we expect to get a whole lot more, probably about 300,000 pounds.
Wow, 300,000 pounds. What does that look like stacked up in a big
room? It's pretty extraordinary. It's many, many, many semi-truckloads full.
So in trying to save kids from eating too much sugar at Halloween, could we be promoting tooth decay in our troops by participating? Blaschek says, absolutely not.
We also send toothbrushes and toothpaste along with the candies.
And she says each service member gets only a few pieces. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
As you know, Steve and I share hosting duties here on Morning Edition with David Greene. Not the former Georgia quarterback David Greene, or TV director David Greene, or Welsh hurdler David Greene. But do a Google search for David Greene and all those other folks will show up too. Sharing names has never been as obvious as it is today, with search engines and social media reminding us how unspecial we really are. NPR's Elise Hugh explores the difficulty of distinguishing yourself online when so many others go by the same name.
My name is Justin Dane. I'm a video journalist in Austin, Texas.
Justin Dane isn't the only Justin Dane, spelled D-E-H-N.
This is Justin.
No, wait a second. This is Justin.
What's up, dude?
How you doing, man?
After Justin Dane saw his own name on Facebook, but tied to an entirely different identity, Justin Dane friended the other Justin Dane, who's also in video production, but in Minneapolis.
And then I wrote you and I said, hey, I don't think we've ever met, but I'm assuming that you're adding me because we have the same name. And then we chatted a little bit of how we pronounced it.
Since then, they've dealt with their share of name-related mishaps.
I was getting emails from your girlfriend at the time, just like with just normal everyday notes like, hey, don't forget to take the trash out. Or
yeah.
I think I forwarded some to you like, don't forget to take the trash out.
Yeah, you did.
This kind of confusion caused by same-nameness isn't new, but now it's easier than ever to find others with your name online. And with more all-digital communication, mix-ups matter more, too. Judith Donath is a researcher at Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. She says online names are everything.
One of the most important things online is the reputation you build up. It's really the entirety of your identity in a world where there is no body. And when you share your name with many other people, you start sharing effectively a history and reputation with them.
In 2005, writer Mike Sager wasn't keen to share his name with so many other Mike Sagers.
I need to use my name. I'm Mike Sager. I'm Mike Sager. I am Mike Sager.
But since he isn't the only one, Sager set out on a cross-country journey to meet the other Mike Sagers.
There was Lutheran pastor Mike Sager in Spokane. There was motorcycle racer sound technologist Mike Sager in Wenatchee, Washington. In all, I ended up getting in touch with 39 Mike Sagers and going to meet 11 Mike Sagers.
The road trip reminded him, we may all want to be distinct, but we can't deny we're linked.
It gives you a better view on how we're all related in different ways as humans. And, you know, particularly by name, even if we don't know each other.
But what if you share a name with someone less than appealing, someone with a bad reputation?
We call that at Reputation.com, we call that the doppelnamer problem, obviously after the doppelganger problem, where you share the name with someone who's got a bad rep or who's someone famous, who's just not you.
That's Michael Furtick, the founder and CEO of Reputation.com. The company is among NPR's supporters, and it helps users distinguish themselves in search results because nowadays, the vast majority of people you interact with will look you up online first.
So the whole idea is to fly your flag, first of all, if you don't have one, and secondly, so to fly your flag prominently and largely enough, grandly enough, that people can find the full picture of your body of work of your life.
Donath, the Harvard researcher, thinks the digital future should be entirely less name-reliant to end the mix-ups and to better protect privacy. Until a change happens, the Mike Sager name is doing pretty well, at least for the writer, Mike Sager.
I'm just going to enter Mike Sager here. Mike Sager, journalist, author, comes up first of 32,700 results.
It's a little easier for him than others since he's a journalist. He signs all his work with his name. No one fixing a road gets to sign the road. But he hasn't forgotten about all the other Mike Sagers.
In life, that is the ultimate lesson, that all of us think we're the most important. You want life to go how you want it to for you and your name. You know, there's all these other people that feel the same way about themselves.
No one else is uniquely you, but you'll probably have to share your name. Elise Hu, NPR News.
Even as the U.S. economy is growing at a healthy rate, European economies are going in the opposite direction. Much of the continent is on the brink of another recession. Some of the weakest countries, like Spain and Italy, are experiencing deflation. As NPR's Jim Zaroli reports, deflation is a painful process that can be hard to reverse once it starts.
Europe's long, slow economic downturn has taken its toll on Javier Oroz Rodriguez, who owns a butcher shop in downtown Madrid.
We've lowered our prices in various stages, bit by bit, so now we're charging about 10% less than we did a few years ago. It's really difficult because I've got expenses, so it's tough.
Things aren't all bad, however. He says the price of some of the meats he buys have come down, so his costs are lower.
Lamb is more expensive than it was a few years ago, but beef is a bit cheaper, and so are pork and chicken.
For business owners like Rodriguez, deflation has increasingly become a fact of life, not just in Spain, but in Portugal, Greece, and Italy. Ashok Modi is a professor of international economic policy at Princeton.
What we have seen is that the countries that experience the most distress are also the countries where the deflation threat is the greatest.
In many parts of Europe, incomes and prices are actually falling. And even in healthier economies such as the Netherlands, costs are rising more slowly than they were just a few years ago. That might not seem so terrible, and economist Michael Bordo of Rutgers University says deflation can sometimes be a good thing if it's caused by something beneficial like falling energy prices. But in a faltering economy like Europe's, it can be a disaster. Bordo says if people see that prices are dropping, they put off purchases.
Well, then what they're going to do is they're going to figure, well, if I hold back on my expenditures, my decision to buy a car now because I know that next year it's going to be 2% cheaper, well, that means that they're not spending.
And when people in one country put off spending, it hurts the countries they buy from in a way that reinforces itself. It becomes a vicious cycle. And that's exactly what Europe doesn't want to see happening right now. Ashok Modi says many of the countries experiencing deflation these days are among Germany's largest trading partners.
And we have seen in these last several months that as a consequence, the German economy has also slowed down considerably.
And deflation can also hurt an economy in another way. When incomes are falling and assets are losing value, it becomes a lot harder for people to pay off debts. If they make good on their debts, they have less money left over to buy things, which only hurts the economy more. In the end, a lot of people are tempted to walk away from their debts, says Michael Bordo.
It's more likely that they'll default on their loans. And it's more likely that banks that have made the loans will end up taking losses and may fail.
As more banks fail, he says, the troubles for the global economy intensify. And Modi says that can cause huge ramifications throughout the financial markets.
And I think that's the risk that should be of great concern to policymakers on both sides of the Atlantic.
The European Central Bank has often been behind the curve when it comes to addressing the region's economic problems. The specter of deflation in places such as Italy and Spain is one factor that's forcing European officials to reassess their strategy and look for new ways to revive the economy. Jim Zaroli, NPR News.
Now let's follow up on the story of software that lets parents check their children's eyes. It's one more use for your smartphone, searching for symptoms of a dangerous illness. NPR's Jill Palka has been talking with the man who developed this smartphone app. His name is Brian Shaw, and here is the story of how the software became a reality.
Here's what got Brian Shaw going on his software plans. His son Noah had to have his right eye removed as part of his treatment for a rare form of cancer called retinoblastoma. Shaw saw signs of his son's cancer long before doctors did, a white reflection coming from Noah's eyes in flash pictures. The flash was reflecting off tumors at the back of Noah's eyes. Shaw started seeing that white eye in pictures taken with his digital camera when Noah was just 12 days old. Doctors didn't catch the disease until months later.
If I would have had some software telling me, hey, go get this checked out, that would have sped up my son's diagnosis, and the tumors would have been just a little bit smaller when we got to him. They're might have been fewer.
And maybe Noah wouldn't have lost his eye. Since the software didn't exist, Shaw decided he'd create it. Now, Shaw isn't a computer programmer. He's a chemist at Baylor University in Waco, Texas. So he looked for someone in computer science at Baylor who could help him. He found Greg Hammerly. Hammerly and some of his grad students wrote a program that uses something called machine learning to spot a white reflection in photos.
Machine learning is about training a computer to do things by example.
Using pictures of Shaw's son Noah and others that Shaw collected from parents who heard his story on Morning Edition, they train the computer to recognize white eye. They also train the computer what normal eyes look like. That was easier.
We just go out and gather images on the web that are public domain, and we can get thousands, millions of images of eyes.
They've now turned a version of their white eye detection software into a free iPhone app. I caught up with Shaw last week at a conference. He pulled out his phone and showed me how the app works.
So the easiest thing to do is to just search your photos for the white eye, and you just hit the button, search photos, and boom, it starts searching all your photos on your device, and it'll let you know if it sees anything.
So it'll search what's on there, but it'll also, you can use it, like you could point it at me and look to see if I had any on...
Yeah, you can also hit what we call screening mode.
In screening mode, the phone shines a light into your eyes and the phone's camera looks for a white reflection. The app says my eyes are normal. And getting normal right is critically important. If the app makes a mistake and says there's an example of white eye in a small child when there really isn't, that could easily freak out anxious parents.
That's what I would be worried about, that there'll be over-referral and panic.
Jane Edmond is a pediatric ophthalmologist at Texas Children's Hospital. At this point, it's not clear just how many mistakes the new app will make. But if the app does routinely get it right, Edmond says it could be a useful tool. Edmond says the real value of the new app may be in countries with lots of cell phones, but not a lot of hospitals or clinics.
Think about places that have no doctor. Could this be, it's not a substitute for a doctor, but is it better than nothing? Well, yeah.
And Brian Shaw is hoping the new app will be a lot better than nothing. Joe Palca, NPR News.
That report was part of the series Joe's Big Idea.